Well, snow is blown up in my face. Wind is hell, but screams no nay. Cody's not on a frozen high. They don't care the cow died today. They'll lick it clean, take the flesh away. You climb that mountain, you'll come back again. It'll take your life, it won't feel a thing. A snowy bowl is screaming in her name. So high and low that you never know. It's a silent hail that must please the Lord.
Welcome, listeners. This is another episode of The Process. This is a special episode known as the Sensation Spectacular, where we deviate from the regular show and we actually bring a guest on to talk about their process and their career as a comic book writer. And today we have Robert Venditti. He's the writer of the graphic novel The Surrogates, which was adapted into a major motion picture starring Bruce Willis. He's also written a prequel to the series entitled The Surrogates, Flesh and Bone. He's the author of the graphic novel adaptation of Percy Jackson and the Olympians, which was published by HarperCollins, and his most recent work is The Homeland Directive. So, how are you guys doing?
Pretty good, pretty good. I don't know. It's a very special episode. I feel like I need to have some kind of moral at the end or something. I don't know.
We'll do a public service announcement at the end.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, no problem. Unfortunately, Ryan is not here with us today due to a time difference. He lives in Australia. But, we just wanted to talk to you, Robert, about, I guess we'll just start about how you broke into comics or even why you wanted to start writing comics.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always wanted to be a writer. I knew that even when I was at a very young age. For me, when I was, going way back to elementary school, even, first, second, third grade kind of thing, I originally wanted to be an artist. And I don't know how old you guys are. You guys are probably quite a bit younger than me. But when I was a kid, there was this sort of mail-away test that you could get for free for this, by-mail art school. And you had to draw like a little pirate and a little turtle and whatever. They would hand you this book.
Oh, yeah.
And, I wanted to be an artist. My life's ambition was to draw Bugs Bunny cartoons. And so I sent away for that little packet. And I could tell even at a very early age that I just was not any good at it, and so even at that young age, I started writing stories, and I think that was because I was able to describe in words what I couldn't draw with my hand.
Nice.
And so I was always writing through elementary school and middle school, and even on into high school, I took creative writing class and things like that, but it was always for fiction writing. I never read comics growing up. I can't say why that is. I mean, it makes perfect sense that I would have, especially since I had such an interest in art and cartoons, and I read the Sunday Funnies and things like that, but I never read Marvel or DC books or, any kind of single-issue comics or any of those kinds of things. I only knew about those characters what people just knew from the Incredible Hulk TV show or the Captain America TV show or Superman movies, those kinds of things.
So you didn't have any friends that read comics?
I didn't have any friends. No, I'm just kidding. None of my buddies were reading comics either. What was weird, especially, was when I was in like middle school age, a lot of my buddies were reading like car magazines, like Hot Rodder and stuff like that, And man, I just couldn't get into those at all. To this day, I don't understand what anybody gets out of a car magazine. I hope neither one of you guys are car magazine guys, but that stuff really bored me to tears. My brother had a little bit of comics, and he would read Spider-Man, and I remember him having like Captain America and things like that. He was my older brother, and I remember going to the barber shop and there would be comics there on the table for kids. And I remember one, I don't remember what it was called, but I still remember the cover image to this day of this guy standing in the opening of a cave holding a torch, and it's just the cave floor is just covered in skulls, So I mean, I definitely saw comics and I encountered them, and sometimes my dad would take us to the Publix, which was the big grocery store in Florida and still is. And, he'd buy my dad, he'd buy my brother, a Spider-Man comic from the spinner rack, and he'd get me a Tarzan or something. But it just wasn't anything that I really sort of poured over, It was kind of like one kid was getting them, so the other kid get one too, but it wasn't really anything that I would have gotten otherwise, And I can't say why that is. I don't know. It is really strange because you would think that because I liked writing – and because comics had this art element to them, that it would have been right in my wheelhouse. But for some reason, they just, passed right by. And it wasn't until... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Not to cut you off. But I think that it's interesting because all three of us sitting here today had a similar experience growing up, because I didn't really read comics. I read a little as a kid. I wasn't really into it, and I even went as far to go to art school. I still didn't think about writing for comics. So it's interesting the evolution of everybody's start.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a good thing, you know, because for me, just to finish up the earlier story, finally what happened, I went to grad school and I was working, you know, I was going for getting my master's in prose writing, and I was working at Borders. I worked at Borders for about 10 years, you know, when I was in grad school, and then for a few years after. And a guy who worked there was a big comics fan, and I got to be really good buddies with him. And he finally, you know, after talking to me and talking to me and talking to me about it, he got me to read Astro City. And I read it, and I was just immediately struck by the character-centered stories, which is what I was, the style of writing I was learning to write in all of my, you know, collegiate coursework. And it just sort of dawned on me that here was this opportunity for me to tell the character-based stories that I wanted to tell, but do them in a genre setting and add this art element. And it would probably be as close as I ever got to this original ambition I had of being an artist as a kid. And so I had just published my first fiction story at a grad school in the Berkeley Fiction Review. And before I even got the actual book, like, they accepted the story, and in the interim between them accepting the story and them printing it, I stopped writing prose and started writing comics. So I made a pretty heavy shift of gears. But as far as what you were saying about none of us, you know, come from a heavy background in comics, I think that can be a really positive thing, because we're going to bring our own influences from outside comics and all of these things into the medium. Whereas I think some of the problem you might have with mainstream comics is they seem very incestuous, you know, it's the sort of people who grew up reading them are now writing them, and maybe those stories can start to feel like retreads. That's certainly a blanket statement. I'm not applying that to every writer out there, but I think it definitely does happen. And so maybe guys like us can bring a new perspective to things, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, I think it for all of us, it took one book to realize the real story potential with comics, because, you know, when I was reading them as a kid, I never really followed the stories. And, you know, it's amazing how the variety and the complexity some of these books have. And, you know, your book is a prime example. I read that cover to cover, and Surrogates was such a, it wasn't just, you know, this action adventure. It had heart to it. It had thought. It was, you know, just very, very original. And so I wanted to ask you, how did you get started with that book, or even with Top Shelf?
I guess it's two separate things. With that particular story, I guess the genesis of it was, again, when I was in grad school, I took a course in my literature studies called Literature of the Internet, and this is before I was into comics. But I read it, and there was a book in that class called The Cyber Gypsies, and it was a real life book about a guy who had spent time with people addicted to the internet back in the 90s through, like, games or chat rooms or any of those kinds of things, mostly text-based worlds and that kind of stuff. And in the book, actual people that he had spent time with would lose their jobs or get divorced. And I believe there was one that even committed suicide because of the events that happened in these virtual worlds that they had created. You know, they couldn't tear themselves away from these personalities that they had created in this virtual world. And that was just something that kind of struck me and stood out in my head as a sort of basic human desire we all have to want to be someone other than who we are. And it's just something that stuck with me. And then as I got into writing comics and started thinking about that, you know, it's hard to say. I get asked that question all the time, you know, where do ideas come from or whatever. And I can never really explain it. You know, one minute there's nothing there, and then in the next second, all of a sudden you've got an idea. I don't know where it comes from. The last time it happened to me, I stopped what I was doing. I tried to think about it and describe what had just happened and remember it so that I could tell somebody, and there I really can't. You know, it's just all of a sudden, bam, something's there, you know?
Yeah.
And I just sort of dawned on me that instead of going into the computer and living in a sort of virtual world, what if you could create a virtual version of yourself and send it out into the real world and sort of flip-flop it? What would that world be like, and how would society operate under those circumstances? And that's sort of where the nucleus of the idea came from. And at the time, knowing that I wanted to write comics but not really knowing anything about the industry or how to get in, I had volunteered to work in the mailroom at Top Shelf Productions, which is just a local Atlanta-based graphic novel publisher. They do From Hell and Blankets and Owly and, you know, a bunch of other stuff. They're really well respected, but this is going back 10 years before a lot of those books were really part of their catalog. And so I was working in their warehouse and also working at Borders at the same time and in between trying to write Surrogates. And I gave the script for the story to Chris Staros, the editor at Top Shelf. And I was very upfront with him and said, you know, this isn't the kind of material that you guys normally publish, and I totally understand that, so I'm not asking you to do that. But if you think it's a decent story, maybe you can introduce me to somebody in the industry, you know, I don't know, an Image or Dark Horse or whatever. And maybe I could work with them and try to see if I could get this story published. But it turned out he really liked it and said he wanted to publish it himself. And I was really, really happy with that because I had such a good relationship with him. And, you know, I'd be living in the town where the publisher was, and we could sort of build that kind of base between us and all those kinds of things. And that's how the book got out there.
Wow, that's really, really cool. How did you even hear about the job at Top Shelf in the mailroom? Was it just something you saw in the paper or something?
Yeah, no, actually what happened was, this is almost exactly 10 years ago. This would have been April of 2002. There was a book distributor called LPC that used to be one of the major distributors of comics to book retail, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, and things like that. And so in the heart of the From Hell movie, basically Top Shelf had gone to press and printed, along with Eddie Campbell, who they were co-publishing the book at the time, I believe, but they had gone to press and printed all these books in anticipation of the From Hell movie coming out. And now when a distributor sells a book, you might not get paid for that book until 90 days later or something like that. So the distributor sold all the books that they had printed, and the movie came out, and they moved all the inventory. But before it actually paid anybody for those books, they went bankrupt. And so Top Shelf had all the printing bills, but none of the income from the sales, even though the books had sold. So they sort of sent out this desperation email, because all of a sudden they were bouncing checks, and it was because checks that had been written to them were bouncing. And so they were just like, if we could get, you know, I forget what he said, something like 50 people or 500 people to buy $20 worth of books, or 200 people to buy $50 worth of books or whatever, you know, they could get enough money to sort of get through this rough spot and pay the bills they had immediately in front of them and keep the company alive. And so somehow I had gotten on Chris's email list. I think I had met him at a convention, and, you know, he'd put me on his email list. And so I get this email, and I called him up and I asked him if he needed any help answering phones or anything like that. I'm thinking this is some kind of corporate tower, you know. And he's like, man, what I really need is I need somebody to come down and pack orders, because I just don't have anybody to do that. And I had been working in the stockroom at Borders for a few years, managing their inventory and stuff. And I was like, yeah, I can do that, no problem. And so I showed up to do that. Well, it turns out the corporate tower was the bonus room above his garage, and the warehouse was his garage, you know. And he actually ended up getting over 1,000 orders in just 24 hours. And so, you know, saved the company, became a big news story. And, you know, I packed those 1,000 orders by myself in his garage, pretty much, in and around me working at Borders and those kinds of things too. And you know, it's weird. A lot of people come up to me at conventions and they ask me, you know, how'd you get your start in comics? And I'll start to tell them the warehouse story, and you can see their eyes kind of glaze over. Like, I don't do that. I'm an artist. You know, I don't pack boxes or whatever have you. And I don't know how many people were on his email list at the time, 20,000 maybe. I was the only one that contacted him with an offer of help of any kind, you know?
Wow.
And so I think if you just have a little bit of initiative, you know, you never know where those things are going to take you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the industry is small enough where you don't know who knows who. And yeah, that was just awesome. That's just great that you were able to jump in like that, because I think now it's getting harder for new creators to break in and to make a name. I mean, the only way, like for myself, is to just go to the conventions, get your face out there. That's really cool. So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the process of how the Surrogates actually came about, you know, how you guys linked up with Brett to do the art, and, you know, was that something you did? Was that something Top Shelf did? And, you know, how long did it take for production of the book?
Yeah, and Brett was somebody that Chris at Top Shelf had known because Chris goes to the Savannah College of Art and Design and does portfolio reviews there. Used to be twice a year, and Brett was a former student there, and so he remembered his portfolio. But yeah, this I think is the biggest hurdle for writers is how do you get an artist? You know, how do you even go about doing that? And I would have had no idea how to do that because I didn't know anybody, like I said, and you know, there's a lot of pitfalls there. You know, especially if you're doing a longer story, there's no guarantee the guy's going to stick around and, you know, any of these kinds of things. And so Top Shelf put Brett and I together. And I started writing the story in July of 2002. I had finished all of it by December of 2002. And the first issue did not come out until July of 2005. So wow. In between Top Shelf signing the contracts with me, you know, in whatever it was, December 2002 or maybe January 2003, and the book actually being out, the first issue was 2.5 years. And then it was July of 2006 when the collected edition came out. So 3 years for that. So it was a bit of a wait, you know, but definitely worth it.
Oh, I didn't realize that Circus was single issues because I know that Top Shelf.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people do.
Oh yeah, you know what? I'm sick, so I'm not saying much. But Surrogates was actually one of the first series that I followed when I got into comics.
You're kidding me.
No, I have the singles in my single comic box. I still have them there.
Yeah, the singles did not sell well at all. You know, and that was sort of a lesson learned there. You know, it was Top Shelf's first effort to do a serialized story. You know, sort of, you know, we did it bi-monthly, but it was their first attempt to sort of do that kind of thing. Most of what they had done, they would do graphic novels or they would do like a one-off comic, but they hadn't really done like, you know, serialized stuff where it was going to come out at a certain time or whatever have you. And, you know, the single issues just did not do that well because what we found is that the only venue you could sell a single issue is in a comic book store. And there were just a lot of comic book stores that didn't get on board with it. And I don't criticize them for that. When you're dealing with a non-returnable system, you know, and I'm a comic shop owner, am I going to buy, you know, Surrogates number one by some dude I've never heard of? Or am I going to buy another copy of X-Men number 342? You know, I mean, I know I'm going to sell that X-Men issue. This Surrogates one is a risk that I might get stuck with because I can't return it. So, the single issues did not do that well. It wasn't until the collected edition came out that the book really started to, you know, gain some traction. But hey, thanks for getting on board.
No problem. It was actually, because I think that came around the same time as Fell. It was that same year, I think. And there was a few series that I just kind of, like, oh, I'm going to try a whole bunch of new things. I really liked the first cover of that, of Surrogates. And I really enjoyed it. It was something I actually got on my pull list, and I read the whole thing through and I recommended it to a few people. And I didn't have a lot of friends that read comics, but I was trying to get people to read comics as well. And that was one of the series I was recommending. And I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. That's a true story.
Well, I appreciate it, man. I mean, that's what it's all about. If you can, you know, and when you're first starting out, if you can get a fan base together like that and word of mouth and those kinds of things, that's what you live and die by, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so before we go into the question about the film adaptation, which I'm sure a lot of people want to know about, I wanted to just ask you about your writing process when you were writing Surrogates. Like, you know, what for your scripting process, what does that involve? And like, when do you write and how do you balance it with your family and all of that?
Well, I mean, there'd be a difference there to some extent because at the time when I wrote Surrogates, you know, I had a lot less responsibilities than I do now family-wise. So, you know, things are a little bit different now than they were back then. But generally, you know, just my style of doing it is that I tend to just be a very organized person. I mean, in my writing as well as just in general, you know. There's sort of a famous story about me in the family where when I was in second grade, my parents bought me a basketball for my birthday. And I was off playing with my friends, doing whatever. And all of a sudden, I went to look for my basketball, and it was gone. And I looked outside, and all my brothers were outside playing with it in the driveway. And I ran out and grabbed it and brought it in and washed it off in the tub because I didn't want it to get dirty, you know? And that's just kind of the way I am. I'm a very organized, very tidy person. So I don't really start writing a story until I know what the entire story is going to be in my head. You know, I take a lot of notes and do a lot of arranging with a pen and paper before I actually start scripting, and I know what my beginning, middle, and end is. And then once I know what that is, I'll sit down and I'll begin the actual writing. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't allow things to develop organically, and those are, you know, the most exciting parts about writing. You know, one example would be from Surrogates, and I'm going to spoil this for anybody who hasn't read the book, but as you're reading it, you get to a point where you realize that this character that you think is a woman the entire story, you suddenly find out is a man. And in the fifth issue, I didn't know that character was going to be a man until I got to that scene and started writing it. And it dawned on me that, of course, this character would be a man. And, you know, that was completely organic. So I didn't know that in advance. And you still allow those things to happen. But I did know from the beginning what the opening scene was going to be. I did know what the last image was going to be and how the story was going to end and all that kind of stuff. And once I have that, I'll go and I'll break it down into issues. So how many issues is it going to take me to tell this story? Then I'll break those issues down into scenes. How many scenes am I going to have in each issue? How many pages in each scene? How many panels in each page? And then I'll go back and I'll re-engineer the whole thing. And I'll start with dialogue, and I'll go scene by scene. And I don't skip around. I write the story in the order that the story's read. And so I'll go scene by scene, write all the dialogue first, then go back and fill in the action, and then move on to the next scene, and I'll build each issue from there. And I also do a lot of revising. So at the end of the first issue, I'll go back and reread it and edit it, and then I'll write the second issue, and I'll go back and I'll read one and two together and make sure they go together and edit them both. I'll do that again after three, and again after four, and again after five. So by the time I've finished writing the fifth issue, I've revised the first issue like six times, you know?
Wow. And do you edit all your stuff, or do you have someone else look at it sometimes?
I do a lot of self-editing, you know, like I say, through all those revisions. And I do all of that before I'll ever hand it over to an editor. But then an editor will come in. And I think that they're a valuable part of the process because as the writer, I already know what's in my head and what I'm trying to say. Whereas an editor is an outside perspective. And so they can see things that maybe I'm not communicating as clearly as I think that I am. And that can be really valuable. So I work with editors as well, but I do a lot of my own editing up front.
That's really great. I mean, your process is very extensive. It's awesome.
Yeah, I'm not the fastest writer out there, that's for sure.
Yeah, how long would you say it well, I know that you know, the Surrogates was single issues, the Homeland Directive was a graphic novel. When you're writing, are you breaking them up into issues, or are you just, is that kind of as a story beat, even though it's not going to be printed that way?
Well, the thing of it is, I wrote The Surrogates in 2002, like I said. I finished it end of 2002. I actually started writing The Homeland Directive probably around 2004, you know?
Okay.
And I wrote it, and same thing with Surrogates. It could be either single issues or it could be a graphic novel because I wanted to keep my options open, you know? And so Homeland Directive, the page counts on all the individual chapters all work out. If they wanted to be single issues, they could be, you know. Flesh and Bone, I didn't do that as much. By the time I got around to writing Flesh and Bone, which was probably around, gosh, I don't know, 2007 maybe when I started on that. I started on Flesh and Bone after Homeland Directive was already finished, you know. So in terms of publication, Homeland Directive is my newest book, but Flesh and Bone is the newest, latest thing that I've written, you know, except for the Percy Jackson stuff. But with Flesh and Bone, I knew it was going to go right to graphic novel because I'd already learned the lesson with the serialized issues of Surrogates. And so it's sort of these four chapters with an eight-page epilogue kind of thing. It doesn't match up into even chunks the way the other books do. But, you know, I intentionally kept my options open so that they could either be serialized or collected, either one, you know.
Did you know ahead of time that it was going to be a top shelf, or was that – were you going to leave it open to, like, pitch around to anybody else?
What, Homeland Directive?
Well, like, and any of your books in general. Like, maybe after your first run of Surrogates came out.
After Surrogates came out, I mean, I knew that if I ever did any more Surrogate stories, they would be with Top Shelf, you know, because that's where Surrogates had landed. But with Homeland Directive, I wasn't sure. I mean, I wanted it to be at Top Shelf, and I was happy that it was. But I wasn't expecting Top Shelf to publish it. Like I say, it's not really their business model. They're very expensive books for Top Shelf to do. Normally, you know, 99% of the stuff Top Shelf does is a writer-artist who does everything himself, and it's black and white, you know? Whereas with the books that I do, Top Shelf has to get involved with a page rate and these kinds of things, and that's not really their business model. So I didn't expect them to publish it, but I was happy to have them do it. And the reason why it sort of came out later, it was originally supposed to come out in 2009, But the production of the film happened so fast that they pushed Homeland Directive back so that they could put Flesh and Bone out, you know, in time to coincide with the movie. Because I'd always wanted Surrogates to be three graphic novels, and, you know, might as well get two of them out there when the movie comes out as opposed to just one. And then Homeland Directive was supposed to come out in 2010, but, you know, the publishing industry was in such flux at that point. Top Shelf pretty much delayed their entire publishing schedule for, I don't know, maybe 6 or 8 months. And so Homeland Directive didn't end up coming out until 2011. So.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, Homeland Directive was just another fantastic book. I did mention it on one of the earlier episodes of the show, and I'm guessing that Top Shelf had a hand in finding Mike Huddleston for the art.
They did. Yep, they did.
It's really great.
That guy's amazing. Yeah. That guy is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, he was sending pages to me in the beginning, and I didn't even know what to make of them because, again, still I don't know a lot about comics and. And it was unlike anything I'd ever seen, you know. I mean, I just emailed him back, and I was like, I don't know what you're doing here. I couldn't even describe how to do it, but it looks awesome. So just keep on trucking, you know. Like, people ask me how much of, you know, his art or his coloring or, you know, backgrounds or any of those things are part of the script. It's none of it, you know. I couldn't even conceive of something like that, you know. So I was, you know, really, really happy with the way things turned out, you know.
And with the collaboration of artists, how much time do you have to chat with them, or is it just right into the pages?
Yeah, really, I don't correspond with the artist very much at all. You know, every book I've ever written to date, including the project I'm working on right now that I can't say what it is, but everything I've ever written, I have written not knowing who the artist is going to be in advance, you know. I guess except for Flesh and Bone, because I knew that was going to be Weldley, but I didn't know who the artist was going to be on Surrogates when I wrote it, or Homeland Directive, or the Percy Jackson adaptations, or, you know, the issue of Iron Man I wrote. I didn't know who any of the artists were going to be for any of these kinds of things. And so I've never had a chance to write to anybody's style. And also that means that by the time the artist gets on board, the story is usually completely done. And so I just hand it over to the artist, and I try to stay out of their way if they reach out to me because they have questions about things or whatever, you know, I'm happy to have a relationship with them, but I don't want them to feel like that they have to check in with me all the time. And so usually I'll just get pages when there's 12 done or 20 done or whatever. And I'll go through the pages and review them and make, you know, as few notes as possible, and, just let the artist keep doing what they're doing, you know?
Yeah. That sounds a lot like, Brian K. Vaughan's, style of writing. Like, he'll write a script and polish it to the point when he submits it to the artist, he's like, he literally, I've talked to artists who've worked with him, and they say he's the best to work with because he doesn't really need any input. Like, he says, just draw the pages, and he's fully confident in the script, and if he's fully confident in the artist, it's going to work out. Have you been reading more comics now that you're actually writing them?
I mean, obviously I read a lot more than I did when I was younger because I wasn't reading any. But I don't get to read as many comics as I would like to, you know. It's just the nature of always having to work, you know, and you're always writing and these kinds of things. And it's just, where do you find the time? But I definitely do read them, you know, every chance I get. I'm trying to think of what some of the ones I've read recently that I really enjoyed. Here, let me wander over to my bookshelf. Infinite Kung Fu, I don't know if you've read that. It's a new graphic novel from Top Shelf by Keegan MacLeod. That book was great. I really like Eddie Campbell's stuff. He's probably my favorite guy working in comics today, both as a writer and as an artist. He's just extraordinary. I'm reading the Olympian series of graphic novels that First Second is putting out. I'm going back and reading a lot of reprints. You know, I'm really, really enjoying Gotham Central. I'm buying those hardcovers and reading those, and I just can't figure out how that series got canceled. It's really, really good. I just read all five of Nathan Edmondson's, and I don't know how to say the other guy's names. I can spell it for you, but Who is Jake Ellis? I just read all those. I enjoyed those. So, you know, I try to read when I can, but I don't get to. Oh, and Six Gun, too. I like Six Gun a lot, but I don't get to get to it as much as I would like.
Yeah, Mike, I guess the reason I'm asking is because now that, you know, you're writing them, do you have any projects that you're working on that you really would, you have an artist in mind and you'd really like to collaborate with them rather than doing the process you're doing now?
Yeah, there are some guys out there I would really like to work with for sure. I don't know if I want to name them because it would be to the exclusion of other people, but they know who they are because I've said it to them, you know? So it would be nice if we could work that out down the road.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, so I guess we can start talking, or I'd like to talk about the film adaptation, because I know that obviously right now the popularity with comic books in Hollywood is kind of has a spotlight on it, and everything's getting greenlit left and right, and it's all very exciting for comic book creators, but you know, I just would like to know from your experience, what is the reality of a situation like that where you put out a book and you garner interest, and what is that whole process, and if you liked it, didn't like it, what you learned and whatnot?
I mean, I had a great time with it. You know, the movie actually came out, you know, obviously very different from the graphic novel, but that doesn't bother me, you know. Sort of my whole perspective on it from the beginning was, if there are these people who want to invest their time and their energy because they're inspired by my story to do something of their own creatively, then I just want to get out of their way and let them do it. I don't want them to feel like I'm sitting there managing their creativity. I kind of liken it to, if I had a song and somebody wanted to do a cover of my song and I told them that their version had to sound exactly like my version, then why would they want to do it, you know?
That's good.
I told the story the way I wanted to. Somebody else wants to do it some other way, let them do it, you know? As far as getting the interest, it was the kind of thing really where the producers came to us. You know, by the time that the collected edition was out, there had been enough press and I guess enough buzz on the book. And I guess it had that sort of, I don't know, what do they call it? High concept that producers and filmmakers like so much that they could sort of latch onto. And all of this, of course, completely unintended. I didn't know that anybody was even going to publish it, you know, much less have any of this happen. But so the producers approached us and asked us about the rights, and we told them they were available, and they wanted some time to go out and try to see if they could put a team together with a director and screenwriters and things like that. And we sort of did it two different ways. At first, there was this big rush of producers, and we sort of divided them all up. And the way it works is some producers in Hollywood will have a first look deal with a certain studio. And you have whatever the number of studios are, 7 or 8 or whatever. You know, you've got Warner Brothers, Fox, Sony, used to be New Line, MGM, Disney, Paramount. I'm probably missing somebody in there. But anyhow, so you'll try to pick one producer whose first look deal is at Warner Brothers, another whose first look deal is at Sony, another whose first look deal is at Paramount, another at Disney, so on and so on, and have them all go out and put their teams together and pitch it to their relative studios all in the same week, with the hope that two or more of the studios will want it, and then you get into a bidding war and you get rich beyond your wildest dreams and right off into the sunset. That is what happened with Surrogates. Those guys went out and they all made their pitches. None of them stuck. And I wonder in retrospect if some of the people involved weren't really invested in the story so much as they just thought it was something they could make a movie out of, and maybe they were just going in that day to a pitch meeting and pitching a dozen things and seeing what stuck to the wall, you know? And so that all sort of flamed out and nothing happened there. And then months later, the producers approached us actually contacted me on the phone, and his name was Max Handelman, and he asked me if the rights were available, and I said yeah, and he said that he wanted to basically have all of Hollywood. He didn't have a first look deal with any kind of studio, and he just wanted to be able to go out and put a pitch together and pitch it to whoever he wanted. And I just liked Max personally, and I could tell that he really liked the story and was really a big fan of the project. And so he was the guy that went out and then joined up with Mandeville Films, and they put the team together, and they're the ones that actually ended up getting it made. So, you know, there's different ways you can go about doing it. I tried two. The first one failed, and the second one worked, you know?
Oh, awesome. And did you have any involvement whatsoever once it started, when it was adapted?
I was a consultant on the screenplay, but again, I really tried to stay out of it. You know, I just sort of took part in it as a happy observer, you know, going to the set and watching filming and going to the premiere and those kinds of things, but I didn't really want to be over-involved, you know. For a guy whose first book coming out of a warehouse, you know, like I was. I didn't feel like I was in any kind of position to demand that I get to write the screenplay or anything like that, you know. So I just wanted them to be able to do whatever they needed to do to get the film made and just stay out of the way and let it happen, you know.
Yeah. And do you have any personal opinions on because you're writing, are you writing specifically comic books now, or are you still writing prose?
Actually, I'm working on a prose novel right now as well, and I actually, with a really good friend of mine, Van Jensen, we actually just finished our first screenplay, so doing a few different things right now.
That's great. And when you're writing a screenplay or you're writing prose or a comic book, you seem like the type that, you know, you write something and that's how it's going to be delivered through that system, whether it's through a film, whether it's through a comic book, whether it's through a book. Do you have any personal opinions on people that, you know, decide they can't make a screenplay into a movie, so they're going to make it into a comic book, and how that translates and all that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you're right. I am that kind of person. You know, I think that for whatever reason, when you first think of a story, you think of it in a certain format, you know, and I, for me, that's just where it sort of becomes cemented, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know how it would work if I wrote something as a screenplay and it didn't work, and so I decided I was going to turn it into a comic. I don't know. It'd be like you're adapting yourself at that point, you know?
Yeah.
How do you adapt your own work? I guess it would seem, I guess, a bit odd. I don't know. I'm sure there's certainly instances where it's happened and it's worked, but for me, I just think that whatever the original genesis of the idea is, that's sort of where the format stays. You know, now if they had asked me to write the screenplay for The Surrogates, I would have done that. And, you know, I don't know how it would have turned out. I haven't tried to adapt my own work before, but that was part of the challenge of why I wanted to take on the Percy Jackson novels, because I had just been through the process myself, having one of my projects adapted to another format. And so I wanted to know what that adaptation thing looked like. How do I take something that was originally a novel and turn it into a comic, you know? And actually, it was a great challenge, and I had a lot of fun doing it. So, you know, maybe I would be able to adapt something of my own. It's hard to say. I guess I won't ever know until that happens.
Sure. And the Percy Jackson material, so with the way you described how you format and your process of writing a comic book, did that still apply? You just, you know, read the material and then just filtered it through your process?
Yeah, very much so. You know, it was my guiding principle with the Percy Jackson adaptations was I wanted to stay as absolutely 100% faithful to the novel as I could within the confines of taking a 375-page novel and making 125 pages of comics.
Right.
And so I went through and I read the entire book, and then I read the rest of the series of books, because I wanted to know if I changed anything now that it wasn't going to come back in book four or whatever. And the fifth book wasn't even published yet, so I got to read like the Word document of it before it was even in print, you know, which was kind of cool. Probably one of the first people in the world to read that, you know. But I went and then went back and read the first book again and broke it down chapter by chapter into how many comic book pages I think it would take me to tell each chapter. And, you know, combined two scenes into one in certain places, or, you know, took out scenes if I had to because they weren't as germane necessarily to the central through line and the character arcs and all those kinds of things. And then I sort of presented an entire breakdown, what changes I was going to make, you know, all these kinds of things, and presented it to Hyperion, the publisher, who then passed it along to Rick Riordan, the author of the novels, so that he knew what my game plan was going forward before I even wrote anything, because I wanted him to know how much I was going to respect his original source material. So I did get really organized with it before I did any of the writing, and I've done three of those books now, and I'm now working on another project for Hyperion, and I'm doing it the same way. So, yeah, you know, it seems to have worked out pretty well.
And was that a personal project you wanted to take on, or did someone approach you about it?
The other one for Hyperion?
Well, the Percy Jackson material.
Oh, yeah. No, I was actually at New York Comic Con, and this would be 2009, I think. Yeah, 2009. No. I'm trying to think now. Yeah, it was 2009. It was the last year that it was in February. And so it was about, I guess, 7 months before the Surrogates movie came out. And I went to the convention, even though I had no desire to be in New York City in February because I was born and raised in South Florida. And I went to the convention because they were going to roll out the very first press for the Surrogates film there. And it's just one of those things, like you said earlier, you know, just going to conventions and meeting people and putting yourself out there. I just happened to be in the room, and a guy who is my literary agent now introduced me to the editor at Hyperion and said that they were looking for somebody to write these Percy Jackson books. They were having a hard time finding a writer. And so I gave them my stuff, and they gave me the copy of The Lightning Thief. And I went home and read it and sort of gave them my pitch for how I would do the book. And I ended up getting the job, which I was stunned. I mean, there had to be a lot of competition for that job, I would imagine, sure. Because it's such a high-profile series, you know. And at that point, the only thing I'd published was The Surrogates. So, but it seems to have worked out.
Wow. So I don't know. Curtis, do you have anything?
Yeah, my voice is pretty much done, so I'm not going to say too much. I mean, it was really insightful to hear what you had to say about it. And, I mean, who would have thought that, you know, 6 years down the road, I'd be talking to the guy who wrote one of the first series I bought. That's pretty cool.
I think that's one of the great things about comics, too. You know, when I go and you know, sometimes I speak at colleges or creative writing classes or whatever, and they ask about getting in. And, you know, I'd be curious to ask. I don't know really any musicians or painters or any of those kinds of things, but I'd be curious to ask them if there was some sort of convention circuit built into your medium where you could go and meet like-minded people and record label execs and all those kinds of things, like how much would you go do that, you know? And that's the great thing about comics. There's this infrastructure already in place where it's a big industry, but everybody has an opportunity to talk to and pick anybody's brain at any time, you know? So that's one of the things that I really like about it as a medium and as a business. And, you know, just the community aspect of it, I think is great. And anybody who wants to get into it that doesn't take advantage of those kinds of things, I think is doing it to their own disservice.
No, absolutely. We talked about it on one of the episodes where community, I mean, that's personally what I love about writing comic books and trying to establish myself. And it's not something anyone ever told me about. It's just, you know, I like to network. I like to talk to people. I like to know what, you know, what makes them tick and how they got to achieve the goals that they wanted. And in comics, it's a very small knit community, and there's disadvantages and advantages to it. But yeah, the convention circuit is definitely grueling. Curtis and I just went through New York Comic Con, and I think everybody that left that con got sick in some way or another. but just a lot of late nights and long days, a lot of walking, especially in New York. But yeah, you know, I think that's what's great about writing is that you're not. I mean, I think it might be different for you because you're writing prose and you're writing a novel, but with comics you get to interact, and that's something that I don't know if I'd want to sacrifice at this point to write a novel. I also don't think I'm a good enough writer to do it, but I like that interaction. I like getting feedback and collaborating, but, you know, I guess you like both?
Well, I mean, I don't know if I'm good enough to write a novel yet either. I guess we're going to find out when I'm done, you know? But it's been a long time since I went prose, so we'll see how it goes. It's just one of those things where that's sort of the way the idea hit me, and so that's what I'm going to try to do. But I do like that community aspect of comics, and it would be great if that same sort of thing applied, and it does to some extent. You know, there are a lot of book festivals out there you can go to and sort of mingle with all these kinds of people, and that's great. So I don't know that it's necessarily an either or scenario there, but I do think that if you're in some businesses like the music business, you know, you just don't have those kinds of resources. So I do think it's a great asset for us.
Yeah, I think so too. You brought up a good point about what the convention actually serves to creators, because I think, you know, I think about the hoops that my friends in LA have to jump through to get a screenplay read.
Yeah.
And, you know, what if there was something, I mean, I don't think there would ever be, but if there was something like that where screenwriters could go and, like, network face-to-face with people rather than, you know, having to attend lavish parties or know somebody who knows somebody kind of thing.
Yeah, Hollywood is a weird place, man. I don't know, man. The only time I've really ever been there to L.A. was when I went out for the premiere, and it just felt like everybody was trying to get noticed in one way or the other, you know? I don't know. Do you get that sense when you go there?
I've actually never been, but a friend of mine was telling me that he had a friend that lived there for a few years, and she said that to her it was like living in a cartoon, and you know, everybody was connected to the business. Like, literally everybody you met was part of the business. And if you could accept living in a cartoon where it's sunshine every single day for no reason, and everybody's really happy, but everybody is also trying to get somewhere, then it's a cool place to live. But it's a very different place.
And I guess, like you say, maybe that's what happens when you don't have a sort of convention infrastructure. I mean, you know, how do you? If I had not gone and worked in Top Shelf's warehouse, how would I have gotten into the industry? I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because for me, a large part of taking part in the convention circuit was riding along with Top Shelf as they were going from city to city in those early years I was working for them. So, you know, I guess I don't know what I would do if that didn't exist, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like for myself and for Curtis, you know, the way that Curtis went about it and the way that most people are doing it is, you know, obviously you can't write for the big two and, you have to create your own stories, but they have to be good. And, you know, with creator owned books, all of that production is on the shoulders of the creators. Like, you know, Curtis doesn't have a production team, editors. I mean, Curtis has that now, but like, you got to put a book together and it has to look good enough that there's all the guesswork is taken out. So, you know, it's cool that you found a niche and have found a small way in, because I think those opportunities are changing. But yeah, it's been a lot of learning. So, I guess we're going to wrap up here.
Okay.
Robert, I obviously want to thank you for being on the show and for taking the time out of your schedule.
No problem, guys. Hopefully I'll get to meet you on the circuit maybe next year.
Yeah, do you have any cons that you're planning to go to?
Oh, let's see. It's kind of early to say. I always go to Heroes Con in Charlotte every year. I always go to San Diego every year. Beyond that, it's sort of in flux. I go to book festivals and things. I'm going to be at Kamikaze Expo in a couple weeks in L.A., I'm going to the Miami Book Festival, which is in November. I would like to get back to New York Comic Con next year, for sure. I heard it was a great show this year.
Yeah, it was.
I'm hopefully running you guys at some point. Are you guys both in New York?
No, I'm in the middle of Canada.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and I live in Brooklyn. Is there anything you can tell us about for 2012 for your work? Anything coming up?
Let's see. The next Percy Jackson adaptation, The Sea of Monsters, will be out in, I believe, fall of 2012. I'm doing a new series of single-issue sort of episodic surrogate-related mysteries with the surrogates. Brett Wedley and I are working on those right now, and so sort of it picks up right where Flesh and Bone left off, where Harvey has just gotten his detective's badge, and each story will be a self-contained story in which surrogate technology is related in some way, and we'll release those all digitally so that we can do them serialized in an episodic format and then collect them at the end. So I'm working on those. I have, for 2013, I have the third Percy Jackson adaptation coming out, as well as an adaptation of another book for Hyperion called Blue Bloods. And then next year, I will be doing my first ongoing series for one of the big houses, you know, one of the big, I don't know, big publishing outfits or whatever. So that'll be exciting. It's the first time I've tackled anything like that. And I'm working on the novel, so yeah, I guess I got a few things going on.
Awesome. Always being busy, that's good. So again, thank you for your time. I also want to thank Image Addiction for hosting the show, and you know, we have a lot of other creators coming up to talk about their process. You know, this is the first look into Robert's work, and you know, we'll be seeing the perspective of all different writers and how they tick and how they write and how they get things done. So again, thanks guys for being here, and we'll talk to you guys all very soon.
No, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Come on home with me. Would you come home and sing my name? Batten down the hatch today. Would you care if I stayed the same? Bathing in the backyard in trouble day with long underwear with a piping gun. I'm pretty sure that it'll please the sun.